Sometimes it's hard to explain. You just had to be there. These people have been there. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we welcome back Aaron McKittrick and Brett Wood Higman of Ground Truth Trekking, back from circling Cook Inlet on foot and pack raft. Our toll-free telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Aaron and Hig are on a book tour and here to talk it over with you today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
And here we are again. Hig, Aaron.
Thanks back for having us, Steve.
Yeah.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to confess I had not read either one of your books, Aaron, the last time you were on. And here you were passing through here and just about finished with the second book, and now it's out.
Yeah, well, like says, you couldn't have possibly read the second one unless you'd managed to, like, break into my computer and find the PDF file last time. But so what do you think?
I think that I really loved reading them back to back. I tend to like to read people that way anyway. And, you know, like, I'm just, you figure out the mentality of the writer and then you just read everything. And so it was a very pleasurable read. The first book by Aaron McKittrick is called A Long Trek Home, and it documents essentially your trip from the Seattle area to Unimank Pass.
Yeah.
And you came on here and you guys talked about that. There's a documentary out on it. And it's... It took longer than you thought, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we thought 9 months, and it was getting closer to 13 there by the end. But, you know, that's what you expect of an adventure.
Yeah, we were doing all right until about the time winter came around. So,
yeah. And it was so it was a little bit more than a complete year for that one, right?
Yeah, a little bit more than a year. I think we left on June 8th and ended up on June 20-something.
So then... So the documentary comes out, made of what little, what was filmed of it?
Yeah, made of what we took out a camera, wallet-sized camera. Yeah. You know,
I mean, this is all. There's a weight consideration here. There's a how many days worth of stuff, resupply consideration. It's not like you're carrying around the full.
Well,
you did rather well, though, actually.
Well, you know, I think we were completely new to videography, and Greg Cheney, who put the film together, he was really interested in the trip, and then he started looking through all of the video and realizing, wow, you know, this is going to be really hard to tie together into a story. But he went with it, and actually it's been really successful, and really a lot of people have enjoyed it. So I guess it worked.
Yeah. I gave him all of my my journals, like all journal entries for every day of that trip, so he could then look at the footage and have some clue of what was going on, because we didn't really include that.
You were such trusting souls.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't going to happen if we didn't, you know, there's so many things going on. It wasn't going to happen if we didn't work with someone else. And hey, we worked with him again. He has another short film out on a trip in the second book on Malaspina Glacier, Life on Ice, and just got accepted into Banff, and we're trusting souls again. I haven't actually seen it yet, but it's going to be premiered in Juneau on the 10th.
In Juneau. So that's good to know. Do you know where in Juneau?
Yeah, it's Centennial Hall at 7, and we're going to be there too doing a presentation on my second book.
Well, thanks for bringing it up. So the second book is Small Feet, Big Land. And by this time, You have, well, in the first part of it, you have one child, Katmai, who appeared on our last program.
Yes.
And then a second child, Latoya.
Latuya.
who appeared on... I don't think she quite made the show, but she shows up in the tracks later on, being as how she shows up.
Yeah. We couldn't really leave her behind. Yeah.
It was a big adjustment. You know, we really went into having kids having no idea what that was going to mean for our adventuring habit, but we really didn't want to give it up. So
you have you got the kids with you now.
Yes.
And you're doing the book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be, what, signing? Do you sell the books there, or how's that work?
Oh, I mean, either we sell the books or a bookstore does, depending on who we're working with. But yeah, we like to do is we like to, you know, we put on a show. So we do a slideshow and have some readings with it and, you know, talk about some of the stuff we do. And it's pretty entertaining, and you can buy books and have me sign them if you want to, but it's a fun event even if you don't want to buy anything.
We'd like to bring a bunch of our junk along. We have tents and pack rafts and, well, some of it worn out, some of it the sponsors were kind enough. I told them, oh, we're going on book tour and we were thinking of showing off some of your stuff. It's a little bit beat up. Any chance we could get a new one? And so we have a few of those things.
I want to see that.
Yeah, well, I
want to see some of your sewing skills there.
Yeah, we usually wear our worn out shoes with Higgs darning patches for the presentation.
Oh,
I have them on right now. So
yeah. I can't darn worth a darn. I really do. I can't see them. Jeez.
Actually, darning's not that hard, but it does take a little patience, and it's amazingly effective on shoes. The shoes I have on right now, I think it would have taken about 5 pairs of shoes to go as long without, if I was just replacing them every time my foot started falling out the side. So.
And if you're on the middle of Malaspina Glacier and you don't have 5 pairs of shoes, that's about the only option.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I guess the soles, we can easily get into talking about gear forever, but, you know, the soles didn't actually give out.
It's surprising. And that's been our experience with shoes in general is that it's all that
across.
Nylon mesh. We're using really light shoes, and so I think if you had an old leather pair of shoes that were designed to last 15 years of hiking, then maybe the sole would be the first thing to go. But with the lighter shoes, and we have very very light ones we're using now, these barefoot style running shoes, it's all that mesh that, you know, they love their nylon mesh, but it gives way really quick.
Cool.
We've discussed that Higgs should just darn an entire shoe out of the really tough thread, and then that would be perfect. We could just use that.
Monofilament? What would you use?
No, a Spectra fishing line. So like a 100-pound test Spectra fishing line.
Yes!
Spectra is cool stuff. It's really abrasion resistant. I mean, it does really well.
Now,
with
see, this is the sort of thing that generates the calls. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. 478-TALK. To talk gear or whatever with Aaron and Higg. Okay, well, I want to straighten out the timeline before we diverge any further. So, because it's a little confusing. I mean, because when you came on the show next, you were halfway through your trek along the coast of Cook Inlet.
Yes.
But the second book doesn't deal with that. It deals with the stuff that leads up to that.
Yeah, because I'm just not capable of writing that fast, or if I was, you probably wouldn't want to read it anyway. So actually, I'd sent that book all the way out to the publisher, and they were dealing with the last bit of layout and printing while we were going around Cook Inlet.
So people that want the fresh stuff can go essentially to the website and the blogging and on like that, and you actually have associated people who also, you know, blog from time to time on your site. So they can keep up that way.
Yes.
Yep. We're
yes.
pretty active on Facebook, too. That's a good way to go see photos
I enjoy
and stuff
the,
like
yeah,
that.
I enjoy the Facebook stuff. I don't find that you abuse my attention.
We really try not to.
Really worth paying attention to the stuff that you guys put up. So I like that. So the second book entitled Small Feet, Big Land, and we got the kids on there. And you have, in this case, separate treks because, you know, they're small. You got kids, and you have to do things in a different way. And you were exploring. That's part of your exploration process. So now there's the poundage is going up, and the and the number of feet is going up and the capability of the feet. And towards the end, you finally get to the point, you say, I think we've actually crossed the threshold where the feet, the other pairs of feet, are doing more work. They bottomed out.
Yeah. I kind of think the last section of the book deals with our expedition on Malaspina Glacier, and it was 2 months, and we had the two kids, and they were 2.5 years old and 8 months old, and they were both in diapers, and neither of them could walk very far, and of course, the littlest one couldn't walk at all. And it was an amazing trip, but I think it was hopefully the most difficult point we're going to reach with the kids. They've gotten easier since then.
Wow. I just got a note that we can't take phone calls for a while because we can't. You wouldn't be able to hear what they're saying.
Yes, that's unfortunately true.
We have to fix those when we take the break. So maybe we could take the break early. Do you think? I'll tell you what, Dave. Maybe we can go ahead and take the late break early, and do it like that. So, let me just ask another question, and we'll
sure.
get all set. We'll take a break and come run in here and see if we can fix up the headphone situation. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
No problem.
But yeah. So it's great to have you guys back.
Thank you.
I love the way that you get excited about things, but I also feel like the way that you actually are in physical contact with the environment and insist on that every time, I think that the word truth really does apply to that. And there's something really quite profound, I think, writing-wise, in the Malaspina Glacier part of this second book, Small Feet, Big Land. Because, you know, you're a trained enough writer, Aaron, that you know you're exploring a metaphor here as well as a physical reality that really embodies what's happening to our entire planet. And you write not just then of the awesome destruction of it, which Higg likes. Naming his kids after a volcano and one of the most violent spots on the earth. But also, there's a beauty in there that can't be denied.
And there is, and I think that's part of why, I don't know, at least for me, I think we really, you know, in a way, all of the numbers, you can get all of that without going out, but there's some sense of what it's really like. There's always things that we can experience and learn, and it's just different to actually be out there and actually see what's going on and actually feel it and be, you know, have our tent knocked over by it and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I think partly, I mean, if nothing else, it is an amazing way to figure out what questions to ask. You know, and it's certainly more than that as well. But I mean, by being out there, I mean, that's part of how, I think that's part of how the human brain works. You know, if you're out there in experiencing what's going on as far, this, in this case, this incredibly huge retreating glacier with all this complex stuff going on, it gives you a chance to really sort of formulate questions.
But this is violent to the point of imperiling your life, and you have children. Now, what you did do is you said, well, we're going to allow a whole lot of time, and we're going to have gear drops, and we're going to, you know, we make a little cart, we'll try that, and on like that. And you start then not in a Nunatak, but actually mountains in the middle of the Malaspina Glacier, of all things, mostly buried under ice, but there's still the mountains there. You start there, and then you work your way across the ice all the way down to the coast. We get to the coast, and this is coastline that's changing every day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coastline. We didn't even bother to bring the maps. We usually bring maps on a trip. We didn't bother to bring maps. Instead, we brought like Google Earth photos that were 4 years old, and they were still quite out of date. I mean, we could find our way because, you know, we keep the coast on one side and the glacier on the other side, and we can't get too lost, but the details are all different.
It's, you know, right. You write well about it, Aaron. It's an impressive violence. I mean, you get a storm and then you get the storm surge, and mm-hmm. a storm surge coming in to where the ice from the glacier is not actually, the glacier's not like sitting on the water, but the water's coming in and taking it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, we watched.
Totally changing the lagoon structure and everything. And there you guys are camped and trying to camp all this.
Well, rather rapidly until the water abandoning came up our camp in that case.
Yeah. Well, we watched, you know, chunks of Malaspina Glacier rolling out into the surf. And, you know, right now the connection between the ocean and the glacier is small. I mean, It is the largest tidewater glacier in North America, but it doesn't get that a name often because most people don't realize that it's connected to the ocean. But
it's mostly fetched on moraine, though, right?
Yeah, it's got this little thin moraine there. Yeah. But it's deep on both sides of the moraine. It's deep under the glacier. It's deep in the ocean. And eventually there will be a hole in that moraine, and you may be sailing along in the Gulf of Alaska and see a quarter mile wide iceberg with trees growing on top of it float by. I mean, I think that's coming up.
I'm seeing the movie right in my eyes right now as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Oh boy. We're talking to Aaron McKittrick and Brettwood Higman of Ground Truth Trekking, and there's two books at issue, Small Feet, Big Land, Adventure, Home, and Family on the Edge of Alaska, and A Long Trek Home, 4,000 Miles by Boot, Raft, and Ski. Aaron wrote the books. They both keep the blog at groundtruthtrekking.org, and they explore on the surface at the rate of human power and keep their carbon footprint down as much as they can. And think deeply about the world to come. It's very interesting, Aaron, when you start talking about climate change and you say, well, the IPCC and so forth goes up to 2100, and then you think about, wow, my own children are going to be alive then, and they're not thinking past it.
Exactly. I mean, I think that until I sort of put that in that lens, it just seems like, oh, 2100, such a long time from now, you know, why bother to, you know, make your predictions past then? And then when we realize that there's a whole lot of people in the world right now that probably actually are going to be alive then, you know, many of our very young children now, and then not to mention anybody who's not yet born.
Yeah. 2100. And then they just kind of stop.
Yeah.
they're not projecting past there.
If you look at those graphs, you'll often see that's the line.
I just hadn't thought of that. Very sobering. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, and we just fixed our headphone situation, so we're ready to take your calls to talk about the Cook Inlet trek, the Malaspina Glacier, exploring your own backyard maybe, and Little Feet. This is interesting. Small Feet, Big Land. The way that you adjust to the pace of the children, as if you had any choice. But for the most part, in most of this book, unlike the Cook Inlet trek, you really pretty much had to. I mean, Katmai doesn't really do too much walking in this book, does
no,
he?
No, he's just 2.5 at the end, so not, you know, walking as in yes, can walk and explore, but as in, you know, long distances in a single direction, pretty much not at all.
Yeah. And it's so interesting to think that you feel you're kind of over the hump in terms of carrying. you've gone over, and you know, if some other couple tries to do this, you know, you would have plenty of advice for them. Here's how much, here's how bad it can get.
Well, and how good too. I mean, because it's always kind of entertaining to talk about the really difficult aspects, but I mean, we wouldn't keep doing it if we didn't really love it.
I mean, if you look at this Malaspina trip, you know, we're 2 months on a glacier in the fall, and like the place where the fall weather is about as bad as it gets, you know, all this broken rock and everything we're carrying, you know, we have very limited capacity to do any sort of resupplies, and we have 2 kids in diapers. It's completely ridiculous. And like, you know, not everyone has to embrace a completely ridiculous plan. you know, I think it shows that we went out there, it was completely ridiculous, but it worked. It was really fun. We saw amazing things. We had experiences that were intense and incredible and awesome, and our kids did too. It was good for our kids, I think. So I think that I hope what we're doing is we're kind of showing that, you know, those boundaries are not too close. You know, you don't have to go up to the edge and go kind of explore the edge of the envelope as far as what you can do as far as adventure with kids. But there's a lot of room inside that envelope, and there's a lot of fun stuff you can do, and you can really have some great experiences. And I think, again, those are great experiences for the kids too.
Yeah. Well, you had a diaper company sponsor, right?
We did. We got in touch with them and they're like, hey, we're going to be out on a glacier in Alaska with diapers. Can you give us some free ones? We'll take some pictures.
Yeah, this is G Diapers. So thank you, G Diapers.
Yeah.
And this is, just diaper technology. We're already into the footwear technology, and I'm sure we'll get into tarps and so forth. But the diaper technology, essentially, this is some kind of biodegradable, but it's not a disposable diaper exactly. It's a liner, and then
basically the outer part that, you know, has the bits that fasten it onto the kid is, you know, not disposable. You just keep that part, but then the part inside that gets dirty is compostable. So you have to carry a bunch of dry ones, but then you don't have to carry them after that.
Uh-huh. And then that works, and then you would just deal with it as you would deal with any kind of human waste
situation. Yeah, same way with you would with
the woods.
Yeah.
That whole methodology there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to the Cook Inlet trek, and I'm sure we'll come back to all these gear questions and everything, but nonetheless, when last we visited, you were halfway through it, and I thought, wow, you're going to go to the most remote part, and the first thing you're going to have to deal with is a military base. And I understand it was fairly smooth getting across.
Yeah, we kind of just skipped the military base. We just beelined across the across Knik Arm,
You scoped it out for a while first, right, to figure out about the, you know, the
tides. We delayed a day.
Yeah,
you know,
we waited for our weather, and obviously we were planning to go at a good time in the tide whenever we left. And so the first day we're like, okay, the tide's good, the weather's not, and we waited another day and then just shot across. And you know, we got kind of muddy and wet getting into Knik Arm, but Knik Arm itself was quite easy, which was funny because when we came from Seattle to the Aleutians, we tried to do it in February with the ice, and we just never managed it. And so I thought of Knik Arm as just this big, difficult barrier.
I remember you didn't want to talk about it when you were here.
but then in May, it was just actually quite easy.
And now I know from reading your book that, you know, because you were the one that was fretting, and Higg was on, piece of cake. He always does that, no matter what.
Yeah. That's kind of our pattern.
it's unfounded optimism and unstoppable stubbornness on Aaron's part that gets us places. So.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you can work this together. You know, so many couples don't really find that part of their relationship. They don't want to be fighting. I mean, I don't think anybody wants to fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all that pleasant, but it has to be the mutual benefit of the two.
Well, generally,
better than the one, and realizing that and acknowledging that and being willing to work with that, even though every time it's going to be painful.
Yeah, and it's not really a fight. We kind of recognize that those are our roles, that, you know, Higg's role is to say, like, oh, no, that'll totally work. We could totally do that. And my role is to, you know, kind of play devil's advocate and say, hey, no, wait a second. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about the other thing? And with those two sides, we can actually come up with something that's quite cool, but we can actually pull it off. And I think with just one of those sides, it wouldn't work so well.
But Higg's the tinkering also.
He definitely is the
stuff
tinkerer.
Stuff needs tinkering lots of times. Gear. But the downside of that is that He's not always well careful with it.
Yes, yes. Hig is our person who loses gear, but he's our person who can make gear. So it kind of evens out that way.
1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. So do you think you both are still scientists?
I don't think I'm a – I couldn't call myself a scientist because that's not what I do on a daily basis. But
you do – you'll do somebody's technical writing for them or something
like that. Yes, I will. And I kind of – I like to think of myself as scientifically trained because whether or not I'm doing science or doing like remote trekking or doing writing, I have that training. I have that way of thinking about the world that – kind of comes with me wherever I go.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think of myself pretty much as a scientist, but it is still only a portion of my life. And I would say, you know, smaller than half. It's a big piece, but it's a big piece of how I think. It's a big piece of what I do. But it's, you know, it's a foundation, but it's not everything.
As a geologist, I'm thinking that I have friends that are prospectors who probably would say he's passed up all these great opportunities. Does that ever come to your mind? Do you ever look and say, "Oh, that's an interesting mineralization there"? You know what that means.
Well, you know, I'm terrible
actually.
At that kind. Yeah.
But he does. You go and you see all the, like, you're like, "Oh yeah, you could totally pan for gold here." And I'm like, "What would we do? Why do we want to carry gold?"
Whoops, that stuff is heavy.
Hey, if you got enough to be heavy, it's worth carrying. I'm not actually much of an economic geologist, but the one place where I do have my expertise actually applies to some extent is like panning for gold. I'm no good at panning for gold, but I happen to know some of the theory behind it. So
you know where there might be some pay.
Yeah.
You know, we're walking along the coast by Malaspina Glacier, and you see the, you know, outcrops of garnet sand and heavy sand, and, you know, Hig's like, "Oh, you know, we should totally do this with like a gold pan. You could totally pan for gold and get actually maybe enough to fund the trip from these sands."
I think it'd be an interesting idea, you know, salvage logging and gold panning as kind of a way to kind of, I don't know, motivate a trip. It'd be interesting. I don't know.
That's wonderful. You might have hit upon something there, you know, in the post-apocalyptic sense. You might have hit upon something there.
Well, I've been joking about we need to weld a aluminum Viking longship that has a mill built in on rails that you switch out the mill and then you can row on a, you know, you have a sliding seat for rowing. And we can go out, do salvage logging. It'd be interesting.
I'm not sure how practical, but maybe interesting.
Well, none of this is practical, is it?
This is sort of a Mad Max kind of situation. Well, guess what? The calls are coming in. Stu is on the phone from Muldoon. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Aaron and Hig, Stu.
Thanks, Steve. I have cook inlet questions because that's where I like to paddle on occasion. So did you guys get to hang out with the locals much on the west side?
Definitely. Especially we got to hang out with a bunch of set netters who were either setting up or fishing when we came through. Some folks at the Trading Bay Oil Camp, McNeil Gain Refuge, Tyonic Village. So, you know, pretty much we ran into a lot of the people that were there. There's big stretches where there isn't anyone there, but we had quite a few nice encounters.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun actually with meeting people, and the trip as a whole. I mean, you know, of course the east side, it's more obvious there were a lot of people, and that was absolutely a huge piece of it. I think it was the most social trip we've ever done.
Yeah, that's what I find over there too. And how did it go by Chiswick Island?
Chiswick Island is beautiful. We ended up crossing over to the island and spending some time with the set netters on the tip of it there, and we were kind of chasing a resupply box, so we left the island sooner than I wanted to. But
yeah, there was a little confusion with a resupply, and we ended up at different times we thought it was in three or four different places around the area. So, but fortunately, I mean, you know, anyone you meet is super generous, and like it's not like we're gonna starve. It was a lot of complicated paddling about, that's all.
Hey, did you meet Michelle there at the tip?
Michelle. She wasn't there at the time. We met the Kulhaniks, and some of the people working for Michelle were there, though.
Hey, did they let you in on the petroglyphs?
I think we didn't get a chance to see the petroglyph. We had fun looking for fossils, though. There were a lot of fossils there.
Oh, man. That's next time.
Next time.
Boy, this is really great. I look forward to reading your book, especially if you include lots of stuff about the set netters and stuff.
That's the plan, but that one I haven't written yet, so you're going to have to wait for the Cook Inlet one.
Well, how about the duck shacks?
The duck shacks.
Enjoy the duck shacks?
Yeah, the maggot point one. Especially
oh, yeah,
nice.
The big red one?
Yes.
Maggot
yeah,
point.
One there. I always leave them money, though.
Well, so, Stu, have you been down in the big arches down on the Inniskan Peninsula?
No, you know, I made it to Chinitna Bay.
Oh, and, you got to get down there.
Oh, you got to keep going a little bit further.
Or Iliamna. But we don't, I haven't made it past Chinitna Bay and that big bear viewing camp they have there.
Yeah, I would say that the chunk, that Inniskan Peninsula right beyond Chinitna Bay was one of our favorites. Just go a little further next time. It's pretty awesome.
Very good. I hope to do that someday. And boy, did you guys spend much time with the native folks?
And Tionic, definitely. That was the main people we ran into. Yeah.
In beluga viewing, much?
Well, yeah, we saw beluga in Upper Cook Inlet, so on both sides, like at East Foreland and out on the Susitna Delta, we saw quite a few. But yeah, so we did get to see some beluga. We didn't see them outside of that kind of upper Cook Inlet area.
Yeah, that's what I found, too, except for the dead ones. How about Nancy Lord? Did you see her at West Foreland?
I know her from Homer, but she wasn't out there when we were.
Oh, too bad. Well, you can read all about her stuff.
Definitely.
Beluga days. Hey, Fish Camp, too. Thanks a lot, guys. This is great. I can't wait to see your book.
Thanks, Stu.
Thanks.
Hey, Stu from Muldoon. Thanks so much for your call. 1-800-478-8255. We're talking Cook Inlet. We're talking ground truth trekking as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Well, it's part science, it's part travel writing, it's part art, it's mostly geography. Geography, what a great science.
Yeah, and I don't think either of us have ever studied geography formally, but informally, I think we've spent many, many years studying geography.
Yeah, we're speaking with Hig and Aaron, and we're talking about Aaron's two books, A Long Trek Home and Small Feet, Big Land. One of the first book is just basically the one long one. The second book is a number of smaller ones, including one where I want to get back to where you're actually limit yourselves to a very small radius around your own yurt down there in Seldovia. But you also go to coal country.
Yes, we do. And coal country is something that's kind of interesting because, you know, people think, okay, Alaska, fossil fuels, they go together. We got all this oil. Everybody knows about it. But we also have, depending on how you run the numbers, something like an eighth of the world's coal. And most of it's in the ground. But people are starting to think, oh, maybe we should use some of that. And it's a discussion that just really hasn't come up in Alaska.
Well, but it has, I mean, relatively. The discussion has come up. The coal hasn't come up.
Yes.
I mean, essentially, we have one coal mine.
Yeah, we have one coal mine,
you know,
and it's quite small.
Back during World War II, and I think up to about 1960-something, they were pulling coal out around Sutton.
Well, if you look at all the historic mines, though, they're much smaller than what we have today. And, you know, and then if you look at if for instance, Chewitna, this prospect down on along Cook Inlet near Tyonek, if that were to open up, it's vastly larger than Yucabeli. And so, you know, the scale of what there's actually coal mines dotted all across the state historically, but they are mostly very, very small. And what we're looking at today are on a much, much larger scale.
And of course, there's been people picking up coal off the beach and burning it, and they still do. It's just the scale that, you know, is being proposed for some of these things like Chewitna is just vastly different. There's also been off and on talk of maybe getting some of the coal out of the Arctic. There's nothing, I think, going there right now, but that's where most of it is.
You did manage to go up there and take a look at Red Dog, and
yes,
you
know, this,
and with an awareness that there's a massive coal resource up there.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, Red Dog is it's not a coal mine, zinc and lead there, and but it's very interesting because it's almost like it's isolated except for a few communities right in that area, and so you can kind of see the effects it's had on those communities.
Mm-hmm. And because of the local hire and so forth, it's not necessarily a bunch of negative effects. They've kind of had a little, I don't know what to call it, but the dust. They didn't account for what was going to happen to all the huge mass of ore that they're transporting. And there's going to be dust that's blow off, and it's going to affect watershed.
Yeah, and that's sort of the interesting thing about Red Dog is it wasn't a one-sided thing. There were a lot of impacts on the villages up there, but they absolutely went both ways. It's a huge employer in the region.
And I think they've made a really, like, a truly honest effort to employ locally, and really, and partly because of NANA ownership there, they really actually employ a lot of local people. And you know, there's somewhat of a cultural clash, I think, at some level between the industry job at a mine and the village life, and they've worked to accommodate that. And I think that they're, you know, it's in a situation where that and the economics of a mine that's on native land end up working out pretty well for the state. That there's profit sharing rules where a lot of the money from Red Dog, I mean, that money goes all around the state. So, I mean, there are a lot of places I think you can see positives there. But the dust has been an issue, and I think they've largely resolved that. And there's still issues with the water discharge.
So Kivalina has a ton of people that work at Red Dog, and it also has lawsuits against Red Dog simultaneously for discharge into the stream that supplies water to the village.
And then there's the perpetuity issues. The mine is planning to leave. There's going to be a tailings repository there, repository there forever. And I think it's very questionable that they can, that the engineering makes any sense.
You're a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, forever has a whole other definition for a geologist.
Well, see, it doesn't actually. You know, that was one of the surprises when I first ran into this perpetuity thing. Is like, you know, you spend all this time like struggling to try to grasp. Even thousands of years is pretty far beyond most human thought, and like millions or billions. You know, it's a real brain twister to get there. And then sit down and listen to, a DNR bureaucrat saying, well, we're planning to, you know, make sure that they can do this forever, you know, and literally meaning forever, you know, there's no horizon on it. There's no point at which tailings become safe and you can walk away.
This is maybe beyond 2100, but really how far beyond is forever? Well, how far is forever beyond 2100?
It's just forever, I think,
Well, yeah. and I think there are timescales you can talk about, and there's some discussion of, you know, what happens in over 10,000 years and so on. But even in there were Keystone meetings here related to Pebble last fall, about a year ago, and you know, there's a group of experts talking about, well, what exactly does this mean? Is there a time scale we can talk about? And there was no agreement, you know, that there were folks who were saying, well, it's got to be at least hundreds of thousands of years because that material isn't going to become rock again. It's still mud at that time. And if something goes wrong, the mud is very toxic.
So when you went around Cook Inlet, you were actually kind of retracing some of your steps, right?
Some of them. We've done bits and pieces of the route before.
But you had gone to Chewitna earlier. Right?
Yes, we had gone to that earlier. And we actually, this time, didn't go inland to the actual proposed mine site, but we went to Tyonek. So last time, we didn't get to Tyonek, but we went inland to the mine site. So we're kind of crisscrossing our old paths.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you can kind of tell me what you what you saw when you went there. You go up essentially into the hills away, and then that's where they would have to actually just take everything out.
It's a lot of overburden.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, it's a landscape that'll be familiar to a lot of people. It's a lot of mixed, birch, cottonwood, spruce forest, and marshy wetlands and beaver dams. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, there's no, like, sign. There's coal under here. It looks like, you know, a lot of places look.
Yeah,
it's a
beautiful mosaic. It's, you know, it's really one of the nicest places I've seen, where you really mix all these different habitats right next to each other. You get these, we were calling them birch savannas. I don't know what that's not a technical term, but there's beautiful grass with these lone birch trees sticking out of them, and you know, sort of muskeggy marshes. There's spruce forest, willow flats down in the valleys, and a lot of diversity right there. But yeah, ultimately, you know, this is wilderness like we can see in a lot of places in Alaska. It's right next door to Tayonek, and that's where a lot of their concern is. This is their backyard. This is their subsistence resources there. From the folks we've talked to anyway in Tayonek, they really seem to be quite strongly opposed to that potential development.
And the difference, actually, it's kind of remarkable going to some place like up by Usabeli Mine, is that both the climate and the geology. So up by Usabeli, it's very dry, and you see cliffs with coal seams in them everywhere. And you see, you know, not a whole lot of wetlands, not a whole lot of water, and you often see streams that are just naturally mineralized, like ones you wouldn't want to drink out of. And Chewitna, you don't, you know, you actually don't see any of that. You see a lot of wetlands, a lot of water on the surface, and unless you're right down on the banks of the Chewit River, you can't actually see the coal.
And then there's the matter of the salmon streams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are nice, clear streams, and there are salmon runs right up in.
Yeah, and there's a lot of water.
And what would be the reclamation potential? Because as I understand, that's what a mining plan would have to do is.
I think reclamation often means revegetation. So that's sort of what they do at Usabeli, too.
It's not recreation.
It's not recreating what was there before. It's turning.
You can't remake a stream bed?
To some extent, you can. I mean, these are things that are, I mean, it depends on what your goals are. If to recreate what the salmon habitat that exists there right now, may not be successful. We don't have good examples of where that's been done.
And getting the groundwater and the drainage and all of that to be the same. What they can do is they can make sure that instead of having open piles of dirt, you have, you know, something growing on them. And you can see that in the reclamation up at, you know, Usabeli. They put different kinds of seed on them, and you can see the newer and the older areas, and that they start to grow up again into something.
Yeah. So you went by that.
Yes.
And then on down to, I guess, in my mental geography, which is not real precise on that side at all, I know, like, you know, from looking across from Kamishak Bay and looking up at all those mountains and volcanoes, just layer after layer after layer, but I couldn't even imagine what that coastline must be like with those mountains come plunging down to that water. But that's a really, really fascinating looking rock surfaces up there.
Well, it changes a lot as you get to about Mount Iliamna, you know, about Chisik Island and Tuxedni Bay. That's where you go from the huge flats, these mud flats that would be familiar to folks who've been on the water up around Anchorage, to vertical cliffs right into the water. And it's all these, it's actually, they're Jurassic sedimentary rocks. They're all layered rocks with fossils and stuff in them, and beautiful waterfalls coming over, and caves. And
enormous sea caves, like sea caves that a brave pilot could, you know, fly a small airplane through.
Oh, my God.
Literally. No,
literally,
there was one we camped in that was easily that big.
Wow. Yeah, so that was pretty cool if you've got calm water or more or less calm water.
Well, we didn't have more or less calm water. At least we only did occasionally. So we actually camped for 2 days in that particular sea cave because, you know, it's all open water there. So if you have big surf, we can't get our pack rafts in and out. And so sometimes we, you know, could walk the beach. And sometimes there was no beach and there was big surf and we just had to, you know, stick put until it changed.
So then you keep going. And then you get into the big bay where the Kamishak, right? Mm-hmm. You're looking at Augustine then, and you have some beaches there, right?
Well, you know, there's more, I mean, than
on the Inniskan Peninsula where all the sea caves are, but you know, also chunks that you have to paddle and tide dependent too.
Well, there's like a Macadory beach and the beaches out at Douglas River are big, but there are huge sections in there where even though it's not actually terribly steep uplands, it's vertical cliff. Like you could be, if you're walking along the bluff top, it might be only 30 feet, but it'll be straight down. Like you could. Actually, there's one spot where you're looking through a hole in the tundra and you could fish through it. There's a cave underneath and it's deep water, and that's at high tide. When the tide goes out, it gets down to about a zero tide, and then it's dead flat and it's all hard bedrock with incredible intertidal life. Very unusual coast.
Yeah, wow. And you see the bears like going out there digging clams and that kind of thing.
So you would see bears. That's what I was thinking. By this time, it's getting a bit later in the year, but there were still bears.
Well, you know, actually, it was more the reverse. We didn't see any bears till the middle of June. It was a cold spring, and they just didn't come down to the beach. And then after about the middle of June, we saw them all the time.
Uh-huh.
They were mostly very polite bears, which was nice. We actually had an amazing time. We went through three actual bear viewing sites, and they've all picked the spots where there's just amazing numbers of bears. But in between, we saw a lot too, and we never had any bad encounters. We had a lot of just really amazing chances to sit and watch bears do their thing.
Well, give me the chronology. When you started in Seldovia, it was what month?
Well, it wasn't Seldovia. It was a little bit further. We wanted to start at the tip of the peninsula, and we did that in late March, so March 27th.
All right. And then when you came here, when you got all the way up to Anchorage?
Late May.
So if you remember it, like something around the 18th, and, you know, in the middle of May when it's still really cold and it snowed in Anchorage, that's when we were here.
Yeah. And then you crossed and went on down. So you're getting, it's not even fall yet.
No. We ended up, it was still July when we finished up. So we finished up in the middle of July and then spent the rest of the summer in Seldovia and picked a bunch of blueberries.
What was the pickup? How did that work?
It was just actually much simpler than anything we've done before. We actually just got a float plane to come pick us up in a glacial lake at the very bifork-peaked volcano, and it flew us to the Seldovia Harbor. It was actually kind of an interesting transition because usually there's a lot more steps to kind of mentally prepare for being home, and that time it was just like, oh.
You didn't even fly to Homer.
No.
I gotcha. Well, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, it was.
It was very convenient.
It was. Well, a little more culture shock than usual, though.
But it's kind of a nice feeling. I'm wondering, I want to ask you about the culture shock, but we got a phone call from Roger in Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Aaron and Haig. Roger.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what the conversation is, but you did mention something about the coal mine, and I think that this has to do with development in the state that threatens the natural ecosystems and that, I think. So, but if it doesn't, I'd still like to hear your thoughts on the idea of the state of Alaska. It's a state of Alaska land, especially where the Pebble Mine was going to be located, right in all that juvenile salmon nursery, more or less. Now, why do you think that the state of Alaska would even lease state land to a developer right in the heart of a red salmon nursery? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. It would seem like the state of Alaska would say, okay, this is a sensitive, environmentally sensitive area. Let's not open this up to even the possibility of mining. Now, I'm not sure if you're in this realm or not, but if you're...
Well, I don't think it's their specialty, but let's see what they have to say about it here.
Well, I guess I would say that why politicians in Alaska do certain things or don't do certain things, I'm not sure I want to speculate on that. But I think that we don't tend to, the way the system is set up, it's not based on that kind of thinking. It's not based on, okay, this is our land, so we should have a plan for what would be the most beneficial thing to do with it. It's set up, okay, companies come and there's this process and they apply to do whatever. And if it's within the regulations, we say yes. There's no overall long-term, okay, what would be in the benefit, you know, the best interest, despite though we technically do have the best interest clause, we don't have in reality that way of thinking about what to do with our lands. And I would say that's probably the answer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Pebble's highly politicized, so there, you know, it does have a lot to do with what politicians think. But, you know, most of that kind of activity that goes on in the state, it is just a process. And, you know, and that process does achieve certain goals. I mean, it attempts to, at least, to help, you know, balance different resources against each other and so on. We've done a little bit of actually reading best interest clauses or the best interest findings. So this is these are documents that the state puts out that try to characterize. So let's say the state wants to lease some land. So they want to lease some land for potential coal development. Before they can do that, they have to find that it's in the best interest of the state to do it. And that sounds a little bit backwards. You know, think they would first ask the question, but it's not really a question. You know, you read these documents and often, I know we read a Cook Inlet oil and gas leasing. They never even did the juxtaposition of costs and benefits to say, okay, it's in the best interest. They just concluded it's in the best interest and then published a bunch of information. And that's essentially how the process works right now.
Roger.
It seems kind of backwards too, because you would think you'd have the public input before the lease is granted rather than after the lease.
Well,
is granted.
Most of these lands are only the locals are really thinking about it very much, and some prospectors and so forth. And you have to remember there's been a long process of determining where the conservation lands were going to be. And generally speaking, unless there's some kind of law that is put in place that puts a conservation status on the land, it's going to be thought to be available for development because so much land already is under some sort of protection. You see what I mean, Roger?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is one where, you know, they knew about that deposit, but for the very reason, the sensitivity of the environment, the previous holders of the claims decided not to develop it because they thought it's just going to be hell to pay environmentally if we ever try and do this. So they gave it up to these speculators down in Vancouver who now have lost their biggest source of funding. So this may be kind of a dead issue at the moment.
I think
it sure is something. It's like a big detective story.
Yeah, but I mean, when metals prices change and the political equation change, it could come alive really quick.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good enough. Thanks. I'll let you get on.
All right, Roger. Thank you very much. Yeah, he's got a point when he says, what are you guys talking about anyway? We're talking about mines or what? We're talking about geography. We're talking about country and getting to know country with your own physical body. I remember when Andy Goldsworthy, the artist, came up here. And he said, "No, this is how I learn a place is I contact it with my body, and I grab hold of these rocks, I move these rocks around, and I learn the place like that. I learned that what he learned here was he could hold water, he could take snow, melt it with his hands, put things together, take his hands away, and they would stay. He could make any kind of shape he wanted because it would freeze because it was so cold, you know.
Well,
and
you know,
so it is when the real actual forces of nature are extremely dynamic. And when you're exposed to them, that's just simply the way they are. There's all kinds of fun to be had there.
And we really try when we go into a project, into an expedition, a trek or whatever, we try to go into it without thinking we already know the answers. That, you know, we want to go into it not knowing even maybe what all the questions are, and that's helped us, I think, keep an open mind and kind of hear people who have different perspectives than our own and I don't know to what extent we can.
You guys are getting better at the conversation part, I think. There's just so many different kinds of people that you just simply learn how to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and deal with sort of implies this is a struggle, but no, just, you know, just to get to know all these different kind of people with all their different backgrounds and ways of seeing the world, it's really amazing. It's not dealing with them, it's really enjoying them.
There are some really, really striking things you say in these two books, Aaron, A Long Trek Home and Small Feet, Big Land. And I'm sure other people that have read it will be bringing these things up. But one thing that sticks with me is when you said, you know, when I'm out there, I get into a mode of noticing more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that to some extent, you kind of have to stop noticing things when you're in a built environment because so many things are screaming at you to be noticed. There's billboards, there's signs, there's advertisements, there's, you know, even all of the, you know, print. And I think there's so many things that are designed for people to pay attention to them. You have to kind of turn your filters up or you'd go nuts. But out in the non-built environment, none of that is there. And noticing subtle details is actually really important to, you know, your day-to-day living and survival. And you just enter a different mode of how you see things.
Well, what would you... I've often, you know, I'm a guy who grew up around the woods. When I was a kid, I thought the woods was everywhere. It was really surprised me to see there were such a thing as cities in places where there wasn't woods. You know, it was a little town, fine, but everything else was woods, of course. And that contact with the natural world, you know, I would bring my friends that I would acquire when I became more citified, and I would take them out there, and they would get itchy. Oh, it's too quiet here. I can't. It's too jittery. How do you make the... I said I wanted to talk about culture shock. Well, this is culture shock the other way. How do you re-immerse yourself into this more perceptive world?
Well, I think one thing that we work pretty hard at is again, questions. You know, we go out, like this time we added a new element that was to this trip around Cook Inlet. We carried a geologic map. And, you know, I'm a geologist and, you know, always interested to look at rocks and stuff. But adding this new dimension where we could go and we could say, oh, well, we're in this particular formation. We can read a paragraph or two about it and learn a little bit about what people think about it or don't know about it and so on. It added a huge amount to look at. You know, it was all of a sudden rocks that look kind of the same, even to my eyes. You know, they're different, and you start to get some idea of what's going on out there. And I think
that's an even older field than geography, called natural history.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think also it's a false dichotomy to say that you can't exist in both worlds. I grew up in Seattle, and we would go backpacking in the mountains, and you can. And, you know, likewise, we spend months away from technology, but we also, you know, have computers and phones. And I think that you can learn to exist in both worlds.
And maybe we can bring the circle back around at some point. Thanks so much for coming back, you guys.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having us. And one last second, come to us, see us Thursday at the Lusac Library at 7 p.m.
Okay, Wolf Research of Gordon Haber next week. Thanks so much, Dave Waldron, Josh Hedge. I'm Steve Heim.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.